by for Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors with your host, Drew Kirby.
Hey, this is Luke Holmes.
I am Morgan Wallen.
I'm Riley Green.
I'm Travis Denning.
Hey, I'm Aaron Lewis.
Hey, it's Luke Bryan.
I'm Tim McGraw.
What's up? This is Ian Munsick.
Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
It's Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors, and this week we're really focusing in on the hooking side of hooking and hunting. And Jen and I know it makes you cringe when you hear that, but it's also exciting because with the Wyoming Game and Fish Department, over the last few years, public meetings have really become an importance to regulations and really letting the public have their voice heard on things that may be thought about. And when I say and stress thought, any restrictions or regulation changes, they're not happening at this point. They're just in the early stages.
That's right. And you know, Drew, we talk a ton about the season setting process, how it is a year-long process, and how our wildlife biologists are out there year-round gathering data, gathering public input, and doing harvest survey analyses, on and on and on, right? Well, the fish division side does it as well. And I'm really thankful because angling is one of my favorite things to do. And so, just a lot of fantastic information that makes me feel better as an angler, knowing that the science is going into what these guys are coming up with.
One of the things that I think people forget a lot about are how important that the fisheries are to the state in general, the tourism that comes in because people come and they fish at Glendo or they float the river or they spend the summer at Alcova. Matt Hahn, you were at these meetings, and let's just start with an overall thought. I know that you heard a lot and you got a lot of info, but it had to be pretty nice to see such a good response.
Yeah, Drew, I was really pleasantly surprised at the participation that we had. I would have to go back and look through the records, but I'm fairly certain, we had about 88 people show up at the Casper meeting. And in my almost 25-year career, that's hands down the most attended public meeting that I've ever been part of for fishing. Typically, we get anywhere from 0 to maybe 10 or 15 people show up on a busy night. And so just having a lot of people show up is great because that's, gives more people the opportunity to voice their opinions on various regulations and kind of shows that, all the people out there that are really interested in the resource and things that we have, getting more involved in the process of management is always a good thing.
There were five major topics discussed on the meetings. The first was increasing the walleye limit at Alcova, Pathfinder, and Seminole. And obviously, the North Platte River drainage is the concern at this point. That's what the whole meeting was about. And what are the concerns that you're having with the walleye population at this point?
What we've been seeing for a fairly long period of time on these reservoirs, going back with Seminole more than 20 years, with Pathfinder more than a decade, is we're seeing those populations change slowly over time to be more and more abundant. So we're getting more and more walleye in those reservoirs to the point where, a reservoir can only support a certain number of fish, a certain number of pounds of fish, I guess, more specifically. And as you get more and more fish, the growth rates slow down and you start to see this stockpiling effect of really small fish. Most anglers throw those smaller walleye back, under the thought that I'll throw these back, let them grow bigger, and maybe I'll catch them a few years at a bigger size. And that would be true at a lake like Glendo, where, we do have a 15-inch minimum limit that requires people to throw those small ones back so they do grow big. But when you get into the situation that these populations are at Pathfinder and Seminole, throwing that small fish back doesn't mean it's going to grow bigger. In fact, a lot of the fish we're seeing just kind of stop growing at 12 to 14 inches. We're seeing 12-year-old fish that are 14 inches long. and they're mature, they're spawning, they're adult fish. They just don't get any bigger under that kind of scenario. And we've sort of watched this develop for, like I said, more than 10 years. It just continues every year to get a little worse. We see growth rates get a little worse every time we measure it. At the same time, we're seeing our mortality estimates actually go down with every year. And a lot of that's due to people not keeping the smaller fish, right? As you get more and more small fish, more and more of those get released, which means fewer are getting removed from the population. So what we've kind of thought about for several years, and we decided to try and move it forward this year, is to increase the limit on walleye, but have it focused on small fish. So, you know, right now the limit is just 6 walleye of any size at Pathfinder and Seminole. Alcova Reservoir already has a 12 fish limit in place. We did that about 8 years ago. And the Miracle Mile Reach of the North Platte also has a 12 fish limit in place, but it's just 12 fish of any size. And so with Pathfinder and Seminole, there's a lot of guys that are really interested in that trophy component to those populations, because there are some individual fish that get up massive. I mean, we see 32, 33 inch walleye every year in both of those reservoirs. And so, you know, just going to a 12 fish limit across the board is not really palatable to most anglers. You know, there's a fear that a lot of those bigger fish will become over harvested at this point. And even though you can keep 12 fish, people would still be throwing the small ones back, trying to sort of high grade to fill their limit out with the bigger fish. So what we're proposing, and this would be drainage wide upstream of Dave Johnston power plant. So it would include all the river reaches plus Alcova, Pathfinder, and Seminole, would be going to a 12 fish limit, but no more than 6 could be over 14 inches. So essentially, you know, you'd still have these, basically the 6 fish component of your limit that could be whatever size you wanted. But if you wanted to keep more than 6, then those additional fish have to be less than 14 inches. Just give people the opportunity that do want to harvest some additional fish. Maybe they've got a big family, maybe grandma's coming over for dinner, whatever. And it gets kind of difficult to catch bigger walleye sometimes in these stunted populations. You have to weed through a pile of little ones to get to some bigger ones. And so if you've got the ability to retain some of those, I think the thought is that some of those people will choose to maybe keep the first 6 small ones they catch and then try to work on their fish over 14. But that's not to say you have to stop at 6. I mean, you could catch 12, 13 inch walleye if you wanted. So really trying to push some of that harvest on those smaller sizes to thin those small fish out a bit, which should improve growth rate overall of the rest of the population, and kind of bring those populations back more in line with what we know the reservoir can support in a real desirable manner.
So if that is the case, then does the possession limit go up? So if I go fishing at Glendo and I catch 6 at Glendo, will that change the possession limit?
No, the possession limit in the state is just 1 daily limit. So it ups your possession limit in those upper reservoirs from what it is right now. Like if this goes into effect next year, you could now have 12 walleye in your possession because the limit is 12 up there. Doesn't mean you can have more than 6 from Glendo. It's still just a daily limit at Glendo, which is 6, and they all have to be over 15 inches.
But then if you brought 6 from the upper side, then that's fine at that point.
Correct. Okay. Yes, that's correct. You can't possess more than a daily limit. If you had 6 in your freezer from Glendo, then you couldn't bring home 12. Legally, you couldn't bring home 12 from Alcova at that point. You would be limited to 6 at Alcova because you already have 6 in your possession.
Right. Matt, another one of those regulation possibilities are barbless hooks. These, obviously, for the health of the fish.
We've seen kind of similar to Pathfinder and Seminole, just in terms of sort of a long-term trend. And That's one of the, I think one of the real, you know, ways that the fisheries end of things differs from the wildlife end of things is a lot of the changes that we see are a lot slower in nature. It's more of a slow creep or a slow crawl towards one condition or the other. You know, typically most of our fisheries aren't terribly impacted by winter or drought or anything like that. It's a much slower change. So, you know, we monitor the river every year, and we've been seeing since going back to, you know, probably 2016, 2017 timeframe, we've been seeing hooking injuries increase in these stretches of river that are predominantly catch and release fishing. You know, even though it's legal to keep some fish from all of our river reaches, most of what we see is 100% catch and release. There's not a lot of harvest there. So as these fish get caught and released, if that's done in a manner that's maybe not the easiest on the fish, it can cause some injuries. And then the severity of those injuries can actually lead to some, you know, physiological responses in terms of lowered body condition, lowered reproductive success, and certainly probably premature mortality in that individual. And it was getting bad enough, you know, we were starting to hear from the public, a lot of concern from many of the anglers, and we were noticing it in our electrofishing surveys. So we kicked off a fairly large study that was kind of system-wide from the Miracle Mile down all the way to Glen Rock. We looked at thousands and thousands of fish. We categorized the hooking injury level, the severity, and we kind of tracked that with the body condition that the fish was in. And we found, yeah, it's really high in a lot of reaches upstream of Government Bridge. We didn't see any problems downstream of Government Bridge, but pretty much everything upstream of Government Bridge, including Miracle Mile and Fremont Canyon, Alcova After Bay, the hooking injury rates were basically unacceptably high. That really tracks well with some of the population declines that we've been measuring over the last 5 or 6 years. You know, we've got the flushing flow regime really well studied, really well figured out. We know how to produce good natural recruitment in the river using, you know, in coordination with the Bureau of Reclamation in terms of the flushing flows. We've got that part of the puzzle figured out. But it was getting kind of puzzling because we were seeing these continued population declines and it wasn't matching up with what we knew the spawning habitat was. And so, you know, the kind of the smoking gun in the room was this issue of hooking mortality and probably causing some decreased spawning success in these fish. So that led us down this road of trying to figure out what can we do, like what do we have in our toolbox that we can do that might help alleviate this problem. And one of the real obvious ones is barbless hooks. You know, another one is fishing pressure. Obviously the fishing pressure is the root cause of it. We get really high pressure on a lot of these reaches, but that's not one of the tools that we have in our toolbox. We have no statutory or regulatory authority to limit use. And that's one of the things that really comes out of the public comment is, you know, a lot of the comments are, hey, instead of regulating the tackle type, why don't you just regulate the use of the river, especially commercial use of the river. And it's not something we have the authority to do at this point in time. And I think that was a real misconception out there because, you know, a lot of that sentiment was like, well, it's pretty obvious what the problem is, deal with the problem. And it's not in the cards right now. So barbless regulations, in theory, should help with the injury severity. It's, you know, obviously barbless hooks cause a lot less damage to a fish. It's way easier to get the hook out. If you're catching and releasing fish, you should be doing it ethically anyway. Through our creel surveys, we saw that wasn't the case necessarily. There was some percentage, fairly low percent, of people that were using barbless 100% of the time. I think it was less than 15 or 20% of the anglers that were just exclusively using barbless anyway. A bigger percentage of the anglers said that they sometimes use barbless, but not always. you know, another 20 or 30% of the anglers that said, well, we never use barbless. So the idea behind that rule would be requiring the use of barbless hooks. And then we'll see if that maybe helps our problem down the road.
Is there any major disadvantage of using barbless?
Not really. I mean, I've used barbless for years. I know a lot of people that do. You will lose more fish if you're maybe not as an experienced of an angler. I think if you've been fly fishing for a while, especially, and you kind of know how to keep tension on the fish, things like that, you're not going to lose as many. If you give those fish slack, a lot of them, the hook's going to pull out, just fall out on its own, and the fish will get away. So about the only disadvantage would be if you're a really real amateur fisherman, you're going to lose more fish than you're going to land. But in a catch and release fishery anyway, you know, it's not that big of a deal. I don't think you're still going to land plenty of fish. But.
Well, I would think that that would add a little bit more of a, you know, an element of, well, I got to, you know, this is more of a challenge. It's just not, you know, going out there and reaching down and catching a fish. You got to put some work into it.
Ultimately, if it's a lot easier on the fish, then it's a good thing in our estimation. You know, another big one, not only is the barb not causing, you know, physical damage to the fish, but it's so much easier to unhook a fish. I know there are a lot of studies out there that show increased mortality of fish the longer they're held out of water. So if you net a fish that's been hooked with a barbed hook and that hook's in kind of a weird place, maybe it's hard to get to, you're holding the fish out of water, you're trying to get the hook out, maybe you can't get it out, so now you're looking for your pliers, so on and so forth. That just extends the time that the fish is out of the water and can increase the injury severity and the likelihood that fish doesn't recover. And of course, that's relative to the water temperature as well. So in the summertime, that becomes an even bigger problem. And, you know, we for years have been recommending people use barbless hooks, especially in the summer, if you're catching and releasing fish for that very reason. And so this kind of helps solve some of that as well.
Another one of the issues that was brought up at the meeting was spawning season and how you can limit, I guess, the pressure or the issues that a fish could have. And what kind of a response do you get from that when you start, you know, saying, well, let's close the season for spawning?
We had really pretty overwhelmingly positive response to our proposal to add an additional spawning closure area at Gray Reef. Of all the things we asked about in the angler survey that we sent out this summer, I think the most favorable response we got was on the concept of adding more spawning closure area to Gray Reef. I think it was well over 60% of the respondents were strongly in favor of that. I think everybody kind of understands springtime, April, May, the rainbow trout are spawning. The fishery's mostly rainbow trout, and that corresponds with the season when we see the highest angler use. So those days where there's 60 to 70 boats a day going down Gray Reef, that's during the peak of the spawn. And those fish, when they're spawning, they're really noticeable. They're in shallow water. They're trying to dig reds in the gravel. You can see them sitting there. They're really aggressive when they're sitting on reds, real easy to catch. And it becomes a pretty big enticement for people that maybe they're from a state where they don't have trout, they don't know what's going on, or they're from places where they fish for mostly stock trout, so they don't have to worry about spawning success. And so there's a lot of spawning fishing activity on those spawning fish, and obviously that's a fairly disruptive practice. So because we're managing for a wild trout fishery in that Reacher River, it seems like it's a really logical thing to do to protect some additional spawning. The other part of that puzzle is, you know, 2 years ago when the BLM acquired the Marton Ranch, east bank of the river became BLM land. And this additional area we're talking about, which is at Ledge Creek, for about a mile of river starting at the Ledge Creek confluence. Historically, that was private land on both sides of the river, so there was no public access to it. You could float through there, but you couldn't beach your boat, anchor your boat, or get out and wade fish. Now that that's public access, you can actually drive a vehicle right to that Ledge Creek area, which happens to be probably the largest gathering of spawning fish that we see on the river from Gray Reef down. So we know it's a really important spawning area. And just below the Ledge Creek area, there's a second really large spawning riffle in there. So now that there's public access, like you could drive there, you could wade fish that all day if you wanted. I think it kind of underscores the importance of, you know, we should probably close this now during the spawn, because, you know, a year or two ago, it was effectively closed anyway, just due to the private land access issue. So now with public access, let's maybe protect that area before it becomes a problem.
So in reality, it would be a certain area of the river would be closed off to fishing, basically. But that doesn't mean further down or further up, you can't fish.
Yeah, and you can still float. It's not closed to watercraft or anything. So obviously, when people are floating from Gray Reef down to Lusby, which is the real popular float in the spring, they'll be floating through two areas where you're not allowed to fish in April or the first part of May. So it's, you know, you put in at the boat ramp and you can fish for about 1,000 yards, and then you get into a closed area where it's closed for about 1,000 yards. You just have to reel all your stuff up and just row down through it.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Matt. Hang on. We have more to talk about. There's a lot of information from this meeting this week. We'll get back to it in just a couple of minutes. It's Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
It's Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
Welcome back with Matt Hahn and Janet Millick from Wyoming Game and Fish Department. Matt, the public meetings this week, successful, I would say. And another one of the topics that brought up was artificial bait and tackle. And were the same people in favor of barbless? Were they in favor of the tackle restrictions possibility?
We heard more opposition to artificial flies only on a couple of reaches. One of the things that we proposed is at the Miracle Mile and the Alcova After Bay was not changing any of the terminal tackle restrictions other than requiring barbless. So you could still use lures. You could use flies, you could use bait, you know, whatever goes, which is currently the way it is now. We're just adding barbless to that. And then the other two reaches at Fremont Canyon and then Gray Reef to Government Bridge, we currently are proposing artificial flies only. Some of the reasoning behind that is that we already, it's predominantly fly fishing. We don't see much more than about 1 or 1.5% of the total use being using artificial lures. The trout bead rig that's used by most of the fly anglers is actually considered a lure under regulation, that's written. And so going to a fly only rule basically negates the use of the trout beads. And that's kind of important from a standpoint of trying to figure out how the best way to address this is that the trout beads, the way they function is that you're catching the fish on the outside of the mouth. And one of the real common injuries that we saw when we did the study was these injuries to that maxillary process, which are those on the outside of a fish's mouth, or those bones that are kind of angled up and down. And they're important for the feeding, you know, how the fish feed when they open their mouth. It creates kind of a vacuum. It's sort of like all connected in there. And that was a real, real common injury, was either the complete removal of that maxillary process from the fish, or a partial removal, where a lot of times if it's just partially removed, it kind of gets bent over and folds back in and sort of stuck half in and half out of the fish's mouth, which obviously impedes the ability to feed. And, you know, that injury would be consistent, very consistent with the technique of that fishing a bead. So kind of the idea behind the experimental design on this regulation is we would have two areas where it's just barbless, two areas where it's barbless flies only. All four of those river reaches had really similar injury rates in both total injury and also in the severity of those injuries. That would allow us to then look at this, revisit the injury rate 4 or 5 years down the road once it's had a chance to kind of have its full effect on the trout population. And then we could go in and look at those injury rates and kind of make a determination one way or the other, which is the most effective. Is it just going to barbless? Does that solve the problem? Or do you need to go further beyond barbless and start looking at the bead issue? We did get a fair amount of public feedback on the going to artificial flies only. There was a lot of sentiment that, if lures themselves, like in the traditional sense of lures, if you think about, you're throwing a spinner or a spoon or something like that, if that's maybe not the root cause of the problem, should we look at restricting that, or should we just look at restricting the use of the trout beads or that technique? It's not just trout beads anymore, but they're starting to use other stuff like chenille and things like that on the line above the hook. So that's something we're going to go back to the drawing board, decide if we want to go with, like, the simplest thing is just artificial flies only, because that takes care of everything and it's pretty easy to understand. Or do we want to look into maybe some additional complexity to still allow the use of lures, like traditional lures, like a spoon or a spinner, or maybe we just go straight barbless. So we'll have a little bit of work to do on that to try to figure out. But that was probably the one thing that we heard the most varied public comment on, was just in regards to that particular component of the reg.
When a fish, you said, injuries on the outside of the mouth that could impede the feeding process, could you tell that they were affected health-wise? Maybe not as big as another fish the same age?
Yeah, no, 100%. We measured what's called relative weight, which is just an index between the fish's weight and the fish's length. And it gives you a value, a numerical value. And what you would consider a fish in average condition for a river would be a value of about 90 to 95. Values down below 70 basically are really bad. That means the fish is essentially starving to death. And what we saw was uninjured fish typically had relative weight values over 100 in the river, which is pretty consistent with what it has always produced. It's an amazingly productive system. So the fish that aren't impacted at all are in excellent body condition. As injury severity increased, it significantly decreased that, to where the fish with the heaviest levels of injury, we were measuring relative weights even below 60 in certain cases. So it was a pretty significant decline in body condition, and it was directly related to the injury severity. When you plotted it out in a graph, it was almost a straight line. So
for being a catch and release area, you'd sure think people would want to have that better fish to catch, and because most of it's picturesque, right? That's what we're looking for.
Yeah, a lot of what we've heard from the public has been not necessarily tied to these population level effects that we've seen. It's been more the aesthetics of an individual fish. So as a population biologist, we worry about population level effects. We don't necessarily worry about individual effects on fish. So we're concerned about the population level effects and that the implications that this has for the sustainability, the long-term sustainability of the wild trout population. What we're hearing from most of the anglers is that, the fish's face is ugly and it doesn't make a nice Instagram post. So that's kind of where the science and the practical use sort of diverges there, I think.
Dadgum social media.
I tell ya.
Matt, all in all, we've talked about, most of the things you guys really talked about, and it was nice to see that people made their thoughts and let their thoughts be heard. Overall, were you pretty happy with what you got?
Yeah, I mean, having 88 people show up at the meeting is wonderful. And we heard a lot in the meeting, but yesterday after the meeting, I got a bunch of phone calls all day from people that were at the meeting that maybe weren't comfortable voicing their opinion in front of a crowd. And like, I get it, it's kind of intimidating.
Who likes people to be a public speaker?
Yeah, exactly. And so I was getting a lot of both emails and phone calls yesterday from people saying, hey, we were at the meeting, thanks for the opportunity to weigh in on this. This is what I think, people that hadn't spoken up at the meeting. So it was great. Generated a lot of interest in it. And at this stage, especially because we haven't formalized our proposals yet. So we're still in the kind of, you know, kicking the can around and trying to figure out exactly how we want to word it and exactly what we want to do before we stuff them into the actual formal process, which we'll be doing here in about a month. Those will enter that, and there'll be, you know, official public meetings and official public comment period and all the usual regulation stuff that goes along with that. But at this point, it's really about figuring out what people are thinking and seeing if people understand the issues the same way that we're seeing the issues, and then kind of get that information out so people can think about it, consider it, and before it's time to actually do public comment. So that's great.
Absolutely. And as always, you know, Matt did say that people were reaching out, and you can always find information WGFD.wild.gov, their contact information there. That way you can let your voice be heard. Matt, Janet, it's so nice to discuss the things that matter. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Drew.
Thanks.
It's Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
It's Drew along with Brian Woodward from Rocky Mountain Discount Sports. And Brian, I know it's been a busy couple of weeks. You just got back from Dallas where big shows happening and finding some products for the year and next year, and things looking pretty good in the outdoor world.
Yeah, you know, of course, you know, a lot of times we're just kind of restocking what we sold last year, game bags and scents and that kind of stuff for the hunting season. But it's always interesting to kind of walk around and see the different new vendors that maybe things that we haven't had in the past, and kind of listening to our customers and finding out what they've been asking for. You know, things like Phelps calls, you know, I think part of the Meat Eater group, and they're endorsing those calls. We've had a lot of people ask for those. So we've got Phelps calls in the store now. And then Alaskan Guide Creations bino harnesses. A lot of guys have been asking for those, so we're going to be bringing those in for the fall. And there's a handful of just new items that we just haven't had in the past or didn't have a demand for. That was kind of fun just walking around that show and seeing, you know, what was available and what was going to work in our area.
You know, one of the things we talk about this a lot, because you make the decisions here in the store. It's not someone in a big city saying you got to have this. Like, you listen to your customers. Your customers come in, you get three or four guys that want the same thing, you're going to try to get it for them.
Yeah, I mean, there's not too many things that we can't do. You know, I mean, every once in a while you get somebody that says, you guys should sell ATVs or side-by-sides. Yeah. And okay, that's just, yeah, that's not going to, we're not going to be able to take care of you like right, these other guys in town that do it right. So, but you know, in terms of equipment, gear, you're not going to find the, you know, Walmart brand of stuff here, right? You know, we're going to have the name brand stuff that these manufacturers are sticking behind their product. They're going to help you if you have a zipper tear or a zipper's not functioning or a pair of boots wears, and you know, we can facilitate the warranty for you. We had a guy with Benchmade knife that, you know, wanted to get it sent in to get sharpened. You know, it's a service that Benchmade offers, but instead of you having to worry about going to the post office and all that kind of stuff, we can take care of that here for you.
And another good part is you're an outdoorsman. So, you know, you're not a guy that just sits in the house. You take advantage of this too, because if you find something and you're like, hey, this will be great in our area, and you bring it in, other guys are going to follow along, you know?
Yeah, and there's a lot of things that I'm passionate about, like goose hunting, for instance, that, you know, it would be nice if we carried goose decoys, but it just isn't feasible for us to do that. We have to mm-hmm. order a container full, and we just don't have the market, per se, to order a container full of decoys or the space to display them. So there are certain things that, you know, even though we would like to carry, that we can't. But for the most part, any guns, any ammo, supplies, accessories, we're going to be able to take care of you any way that you want.
You know, and I spent a lot of time in here when I was making jerky not long ago, and I didn't realize that the options for jerky making were as big. A, you got a ton of different seasonings, but then there are built-in kits, so you can make your own breakfast sausage or whatever, and you have all the tools to do it too. And it makes it really convenient when you can find that together.
Yeah, you know, when we can at least provide that stuff for you, and then YouTube can provide the rest for you, yeah, right?
Right. You know, it's like a hand-in-hand deal with you guys.
Right.
Lots of good opportunities for you to get in here and see them here at Rocky Mountain Discount Sports, where, as always, if you need something or you want something, be sure to talk to them and figure out whether or not they have it in store or at another store. They can get it brought in to you. You can start shopping and check and see what is in stock or in the entire company at RockyMountainSports.com.
It's It's Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
And we are back. And Brian, a little earlier in the show, Matt Hahn was on talking about the public meetings that they had, and 88 people showed up. You know, fishing is a passion of so many people with that many people showing up. And you were one of those, the 88 that was there. And I assume you being as passionate about fishing as others, that it had to be nice to see people there giving them their thoughts.
Yeah, you know, it was a good diversity of people in terms of there was guides, there was fly fishermen, there was walleye fishermen, there were just everyday general bank fishermen there. So I think it gave a lot of people a perspective on what the Game and Fish is looking at proposing for regulation changes. And honestly, it was kind of eye-opening to me. There's, of course, my passion is with walleye, and I know they were looking at changing the walleye limits on Alcova, Pathfinder, and Seminole. So I was really concerned about that, but that tended to be the least of my concerns when I left that meeting.
As they did mention that this is preliminary, they haven't put this in paper or concrete yet, and that's why they opened the door to see how many people were passionate about some of these things. You talked about the limits for walleye. They want to make it to where you could have a limit of 12 at those reservoirs, and some of the other places was to close down at certain times of the year for spawning. Mm-hmm. And spreading it a little bit. And then this is where the concern comes in for a lot of anglers. And, you know, that's the difference in the flies and the baits that are used.
The one that kind of got my attention was just the use of artificial flies. You know, we have a lot of customers that come in here that are maybe traveling through, or maybe they're just new to the area, moved here, wanted to get involved in some fishing. And, you know, a lot of times that first question is, where can I go to take my kid to go catch a trout? And I almost inevitably send them either to Gray Reef or Alcova, you know. And Gray Reef has always been a good option. I mean, it's no live bait in there. But a person could, you know, throw a Rapala count down or a MEP spinner or Panther Martin. And most likely, if they cast enough times, they're probably going to catch a fish. But that's one of the areas that they're actually looking at proposals to go to artificial fly only. So it's taking out the artificial lures out of the equation. And, you know, a lot of that stems from the hook damage mortality that they're getting on those trout. You know, I can understand, you know, taking out the use of a treble hook because those are pretty damaging.
Right, damaging. I mean, to anything.
We've all struggled with getting a treble hook out of just about every fish we've ever caught. But I do think it limits a guy that's taking his kid up there to go fish. I mean, I think it's really going to be a disadvantage for any youth, you know, especially 16 and under. Spin fishing typically is pretty inexpensive, and people can be pretty successful doing that. So to have, you know, a stretch below Gray Reef where they have access to do that, I think is pretty important. And I do hope that that's one of the changes that maybe comes out of the initial proposals, is that they add a little more accessibility. There was also a gentleman there that was handicapped that, you know, if it was artificial flies only, he made the point that it's pretty difficult to run a fly rod out of a wheelchair.
Right.
And they do have some access points that are designated for handicap accessible people. But, you know, they're not necessarily always conducive for fly fishing. You know, sometimes the trees right behind him are a willow and they don't really but for him to be able to spin fish was an option. So maybe there will be a special permit that comes out of this for people with accessibility issues. If you care about fishing and you like what you do and you like the ability to just run over to the Miracle Mile and throw a jig in a worm or throw a jig in a plastic, you know, if regulations change that to flies only or artificial only, that might ruin some of the fun things you like to do. And so I just recommend everyone to stay involved and keep your ears posted, because after this initial proposal period, they'll come back with the official what they want to plan, and there will be a public comment period at that point.
Right. And obviously, you know, we've been working closely with Game and Fish to make sure that all of the information is put out there. And that's one of the great things about this meeting. You can see that, you know, 88 or so people being there, and everybody had an opinion. Matt's been answering calls and email over the last few days. So, like, people are still really, you know, wanting to make sure that their voice is heard. And I think it's really important, you know.
Well, and I think not only does, you know, Matt and the Casper regional office need to hear about it, but I think, you know, you need to reach out to your Game and Fish commissioners. Let them know, you know, where you stand on the matter. There was a lot of people that were pretty passionate about it. And there's the one thing that was a common ground is that they all realize that there's too much pressure, or the amount of fly fishing pressure from the guide services and just local anglers floating from Gray Reef to Lesby and also on the Miracle Mile side, that it's the pressure that's causing this, the hooking injuries and that type of stuff. And when you have 70 or 80 boats, you know, going through a stretch of river and they're back rowing through it and they're fishing the same seam and waiting for another boat to go through so they can go through, there's a lot of pressure and a lot of stress on those fish. And to me, it's, you know, become more of a put and take kind of scenario where, after those fish get handled so many times, you know, inevitably they're gonna have some mortality. Another concern was a lot of regards to out-of-state guide services that are coming up here, and they're kind of flying under the radar. You know, not pulling permits, not recording day use hours, maybe not even having a legitimate business. So there's a lot of concerns on the river and a lot of pressure. And I mean, I feel for them. I mean, we're seeing more and more pressure on the reservoirs, you know, especially Glendo and those reservoirs that are producing well. And it's a tough battle for the Game and Fish to manage the fishery itself and try to keep the public interest at mind.
Well, obviously, stay tuned because this is just getting started. This, again, just the first week of the meetings, and now they'll go back to the drawing board and the public comment probably in a month or two, I think.
I think they said like middle of April to June 1st or 3rd, something like that. So,
right in there, we'll be able to give you more info, hopefully.
Definitely a hot topic, and I think one that we all need to keep our eyes on. We have our walleye banquet coming up April 12th. It'd be a good opportunity to talk about it a little bit there. We'll probably have some literature there on how to contact the Game and Fish and what proposals you do like and which ones you don't like. And my thing is I'm going to try to offer some suggestions on recommendations on how to fix it. I honestly feel that I can deal with a barbless hook. Mm-hmm. You know, that's one of the big ones throughout pretty much the whole system. But, you know, the thrill is the fight.
Right. You just got to be a better fisherman.
You got to be a better fisherman. And so, I mean, I can live with that. I can live with a single point hook. You know, that might take the guys that are fishing with the Panther Martin to have to take the treble off and put a single hook on the back. But again, I think for the good of the cause, I mean, that's a reasonable expectation that we can work with.
Well, if you have any questions about any of the other worries that they had or the possible resolutions to the problems, you can go and check our app. We've got a detailed list in there. And then obviously contact Game and Fish to let your voice be heard. You don't have to go to the meeting to let it be heard, but you got to let it be heard. So you can do that at wgfd.wio.gov.
Brian, as always, thank you for your insight. Matt Hahn, Janet Millick, thank you guys so much for getting that information out. And if you have a question, obviously reach out to Wyoming Game and Fish Department. That's going to do it for this week on Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors with Drew Kirby. If you have a question, want to make a comment, or have an idea for a show topic, message us on the My Country mobile app. Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.